This programme was produced at and first aired on MPR, Manawatu People's Radio, with support from New Zealand On Air. Ka pai, irirangi te motu, MPR. If you're enjoying this podcast in Manawatu, you could make your very own, just like this one. MPR exists to help people like you tell your story or share your passion on air and online. Check out mpr.nz for more information.
Welcome to Manawatu Conversations, recollections of the past and sometimes opinions about the future.
Today we have with us
Mike Lawrence.
And we're
Alison Milton.
And I'm Stuart Burks. Now, Mike, you raised the issue of becoming parents for the first time. And when was it that happened for you?
My son was born in 1965 in Wellington. It was a brand new maternity hospital called St Helens, which I don't know that it exists anymore. It did become an old folks' home after a while, but anyway, he was born in this brand new hospital, and I remember when my wife went into labour and I took her into the hospital, and those are in the days when husbands weren't allowed into the delivery room. So I had to sit in the waiting room. I sat in the waiting room for 8 hours before the birth, and then the doctor came out and said, you've got a boy. And so my wife stayed in the hospital for, I don't know, the usual week or so, I suppose. And then we went home, and it was quite a new experience. Coping with a young baby at home, of course, most of it was woman's work, but I enjoyed the experience of doing what I could. I had to work full-time as well, and I liked to do the feeding. Breastfeeding didn't work out, so it was bottle feeding after the first few weeks, and I enjoyed the being able to hold the baby and bottle feed it. And likewise, during the night for the night feed, my wife wasn't easily woken, so I was woken up when the baby cried. So I would get up and I would feed the baby, and I quite enjoyed that, being able to have the baby on my own instead of my wife telling me what to do all the time. And so that was the perhaps one of the most memorable things. And then, of course, there was things like sterilising bottles, and you had things called Milton solution, I think, and you put the bottles in a large container with this liquid solution to sterilise the bottles and the teats, and the milk, I think, was, did we heat it? We had to do something.
Yeah, you had to warm it. You put the bottle in a pan of warm water to get to the right.
Well, that was to feeding the baby, yes. But yeah. Before that stage, I think the milk was treated with something. And then at feeding time, as you say, the bottle was fed up to, warmed up to a comfortable temperature for the baby.
Blood temperature.
And?
Blood temperature.
Blood temperature,
yeah.
Yes. Well,
so, yeah, you put a drop on, is it on the back of your hand, and if it about to, or the on your wrist. Yeah.
Yeah. Got and. Then a common food for feeding the baby, I don't know if it exists anymore, is Farrex, which used to be made out of Bunnythorpe, factory there. So those are the early days that I remember, and I was doing shift work, and on more than one occasion, if I was doing a night shift that started at 10 o'clock and finished at 7 or 8 in the morning, I would bundle the baby, my son, into a carry cot and take him to work with me and give him a feed as required, change the nappies and so on during the night. So that would give my wife a restful night. And then there's the case of nappies, of course, washing nappies. Well, that was a problem. We were in Taumarunui, which the winter climate wasn't the greatest for drying nappies outside, and if there was a frost, they'd dry stiff anyway. And of course, dryers were in their infancy. Yeah. We had a cabinet dryer, which was just like a size of a fridge with a fan and heater on the bottom of it. And that That dried the nappies, but it also created an awful lot of steam and moisture inside the house as well. You know, that was a problem.
Did you use Nappy San or something like
Nappy
that?
Nappy San, yes, yeah. Yes, that's right. Yeah. And a good old washing machine. I think we had a wringer washing machine at that stage, so the nappies had to go through the wringer. But a lot of that, of course...
That's right, because you've got the bowl where all the washing is, and then there's a wringer that goes right. on top, and that squeezes...
It was a bit later that the twin tubs came in.
Oh, don't talk to me about twin tubs. But, a lot of that was woman's work, I suppose. I enjoyed what I was able to do.
My first child was a decade later, 75. It was really interesting for me because my doctor at the time was actually the obstetrician who had delivered me. So I was second generation for him. So that was an interesting experience. However, I was going through the labour and delivering my child and sort of came to and had my baby and looked up to see a ring of nurses around the end of the bed. And the doctor looked at me. I said, look, afterwards, after they'd gone, to say, I thought you'd cope very well, so I thought it wouldn't matter. My son was born in the afternoon and this was the first birth during the day shift for this group of nurses who'd come on at the start of the week. So it was giving them an experience of seeing a birth.
And they hadn't asked you first?
They hadn't asked me first, but everything went well. I did. I had a biggish baby boy, and I didn't have any problems, had no problems at all with breastfeeding, so I probably was really very lucky with...
Was your husband there with you?
And he wasn't. He wasn't actually there. It was only because he really almost didn't make it. It was he would. They've told, oh, you go and have something to eat. It will be a while. But I went into it was a bit too quick.
But basically, by that stage, he'd be allowed in the room.
Yes, there was no problem at all with that. Mm. So. He was a colicky baby, and so he was rather unsettled later on, but didn't really have very many issues with as a first time mother with a baby. So I guess I was the oldest child in a family, and I'd had experience with my younger sisters. Including my youngest one when I was 10, so sort of knew a wee bit, I think, a bit, having a young baby around the house, and that was, and he did everything sort of pretty much on target. Although one of the interesting things I always felt about him was we had a billiard table in the house, and my son sort of took it upon himself. He had one of those building sets with a stick, and he pulled the stick out of the base, and I found him crawling around the room with this little stick in his hand. He found a little ball, and he was pushing the ball around the floor. I think he was trying to play snooker. But he ended up playing cricket, so he probably hooked his hand-eye coordination right from the word go.
Yeah. Well, that's good.
I don't have the experience of a baby of my own, only of other people's. And I think something, when I was a child, babies were wrapped very tightly in swaddling, and they just looked like little cocoons. And the difference now is that they come out almost fully formed and fully informed, because they're like people in the sense that they could be sitting on somebody's lap and adults talking around. And this child, this baby, if it spoke, you wouldn't be surprised, because it looks like it's paying attention. and knows what's happening. So I think that's a huge difference between, well, I suppose we're looking at 50-ish years, mm-hmm. between how babies were first treated back then and how they're treated now. But then my stepson's baby, born in Hong Kong and with an ama, so this woman from the Philippines looking after this child, and it slept for hours. I couldn't understand how it just was asleep nearly all night and a lot of the daytime. So whether that's different practices or different climate, I don't know.
Well, yeah, well, my eldest was born in 1981, and at that stage, yes, I could be very involved in the whole birth process and everything else, which was good because it meant that the piece in the delivery ward, I was able to do things, and they say, oh, they just see, oh, you need a cloth to or something, and then they just hand it to me and just let us deal with things. Which was very good, and then I think things really went quite smoothly. We took the girl home a few days later, and things settled. Well, I think we got in a decent rhythm quite easily. What you were saying though, my children's mother is Asian. And so shortly after the girl was born, I brought over my parents-in-law, and they were with us for about 3 months. But there, like you were saying about the baby sleeping, their idea, if I'd come back from work and I'd just be holding my daughter and so on, and they'd say, oh, he's got the baby, we better take the baby off him and say to them, okay, go to sleep. So the whole idea is the baby should sleep or eat, and that's it. But I thought it's far more, you show them things, you interact with them and so on, and they get alert and respond to you.
That's interesting. So that is potentially a cultural difference. Because I was just staggered at the length of time this child slept. Baby, just a baby. Mm.
Well, they do need a fair bit of sleep.
But
at the same time, while they're awake, you can give them lots of stimulus and show them things to look at, and so they're getting used to sounds and sights and voices and so on.
My second child was less than 2 years later, and probably she was really small. I put it down to the fact that I had a very active toddler. And so I don't think I sat down very much during the day during that whole pregnancy. But there were no problems either with her.
One thing I recall, because with my then wife being Asian, the custom they had, one, they used to very large families, extended families. But also there's the idea, one, after the birth, the mother should have nothing to do except things with the baby. There's also aspects of they're not supposed to touch water because it could, I don't know if I remember correct, something like it could make them heaty, which would give them arthritis later in life, something like that. So you'd use the dry powdered hair cleaner, shampoo, thing rather than water, and so on, supposedly for a month. I don't think we stuck rigidly to that. But the idea of, especially when it's just me there, and trying to substitute for a whole extended family with doing all, because there's special food that they're supposed to eat afterwards as well, to help the mother sort of recover from the pregnancy and the birth. So
there's also quite a few different sort of cultural things around when the baby is first allowed sort of outside the house.
Yeah, there's something called the first month. You don't really celebrate the child until they're a month old, after which you can introduce them to
and other
the
people. So you don't
yeah.
let
yeah.
other people into the into the family. Yeah.
When my granddaughter was born, I thought, well, I said to my daughter, I said, well, I can teach you a few things about baby care. I said, for example, I can show you how to fold and put on cloth nappies. She said, Dad, we don't use cloth nappies anymore. We use disposable ones. Well, first time I had to look after the baby and I had to change her her nappy, I didn't have a clue about how to put on these disposable nappies.
Yeah, we used all the... well, in fact, when my first child was born, I made a clothes rack deliberately the right size to hang nappies on to dry,
I made a nappy bag, which was where you folded the nappies in and stacked them. So it was just on a coat hanger with a nappy bag, so you could take the nappies out fully. Yeah, so when you put them away, washing them, you folded them, ready to... go. So you just took one out and ready to go.
Now in that aspect as well, there was something that I picked up from the Asian tradition of using a sarong for a baby. Now I made a sort of scissor thing that you could hang on a doorway, or if you've got a beam in the house with a spring, and you put the sarong in, and then there's a wooden spreader, and we had a sheepskin in the sarong, so you've got a really comfortable place for the baby to lie, and you can just get it rocking slightly either up and down or back and forth. And so they do say don't do it too vigorously, but it's a good way of helping a child to sleep.
When the child's a little bit older, you put them, there was a seat type arrangement, the same thing that a child's legs went through.
But when
the child is a little bit, it could actually get the rhythm going to bounce themselves, and that kept the child occupied for quite a long time.
But this was more with a very young child to get them to sleep, or if they're sleeping and then they're getting restless, you just rock them a little bit with that, and it takes no effort at all. You just sort of.
But that was the idea of a cradle.
Which is going side to side rather than back and forth, a
rocking cradle for a young child rather than a standard bed.
Yeah, I made one of those for my son, the second child, but that's disappeared now, long ago.
Yeah.
But, yeah.
Haven't prams changed over the years?
Oh, yes.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Mm. But also, you know, there are the cultures that have, like, the cloth that they would wrap and hold the baby to the body, but... what I suppose called Western European, it's kind of like the new thing was to bring in these...
Or the baby holder
I had one of those with my son. So, to be honest, you could, with a fairly new baby, strapped across with his shoulders, you could actually vacuum the house while you've got your baby on the... Yeah.
But before that, they...
But this was, it was in the 70s.
But then the different ones that the baby faces you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And my niece, she had one that the baby or the child faced outwards. And she lived in Christchurch. A lot of Asian tourists at that time. And she said with her son facing outwards, engaging with... Mm-hmm. people and the public, and they were constantly stopped to be spoken to, have photographs taken because of this child interacting with the public. So which is better? Facing in or facing out?
Well, that depends on how secure the child feels as well, because if a child's not feeling too safe, you have them facing, they can still look round, but they feel more safe if they're facing you than if they're just facing out to the world. Yeah.
But if you never expose them,
I'm saying it's how the child feels. If you know the child's not comfortable, then you... make them feel more comfortable, and they'll gradually expand. But your point about prams, I mean, I remember probably when we were all born, the idea of a pram was a great big thing, that there's no way you could fit it in a car. But and I suppose there, well, in fact, probably for a lot of families then would be the either no car or one car family. But now, of course, it's all you need children to be able to get in cars. Well, in fact, we've got the small and fold-up things for babies to be in. But then the whole car seat structure. Mm. I remember when my children were born, was it through Plunkett you could rent a car seat, a basic car seat? But how these have changed in design, and these were just for, you know, the first year or so, I think. And now we've got all sorts of special car seats, right? I don't know how old they have to be before they're allowed just to sit in a car without a car seat.
Well, that's it now. All these legislative requirements, is that you've been pushed around.
That is Palmerston North, 1951.
Ah, yep. We've got a picture here of a... Yes, an old-style pram. Now, one advantage of the old-style prams with their frames and their wheels were they're very good for making buggies afterwards.
Yes.
So,
Yes, but they're more like pushchairs now. Bigger pushchairs.
Yeah, when we used a pushchair, the baby would face us so we could see the baby. Nowadays, they face... Or the other way.
Yeah,
so.
A lot tend to. Yeah, yes. But you've also got now the types with the larger wheels, so the mother can go jogging and push the child around at the same time. Which you'd never have seen something like that in the 1950s.
No, I think the idea of a pram, and a pram was often used too. I know even I did, because you could then put the baby outside to sleep, so they could have a sleep outside.
Yeah.
And of course, as a young mother, you were advised to give your child outside time to give them fresh air. And so,
was there concern about the sun then?
Well, the pram had a
It was all covered. Make sure it's covered.
But it was so you didn't necessarily put them inside their bassinet.
Because what I'm thinking at the time that we were young. I wasn't in New Zealand, and there isn't the same melanoma issue in Britain, but you weren't really aware of melanoma when you were young, were you?
No.
So you'd all run around without sunscreens and hats. And
what was sunscreen back then?
The only thing I can remember is we went to stay at Otaki camping for a couple of days and got so sunburned my lips cracked. And there was this product called Tanifax that I think you put on your sunburn.
Sounds like something you'd use for sheep.
Possibly was coming from a farm.
Well, of course, there was always, that was a bit later on, as a teenager, a friend, they went out and lie in the sun and you'd coat your body with oil.
Exactly, coconut oil. Cook yourself.
Yeah, cook your skin.
Yeah, slow cooking. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, no, not that slow either.
Yeah.
Sometimes.
Yeah.
So now all the lumps and bumps and bits and horrible stuff, and you say, "Oh, can you get this off, please? It's so horrible." To the doctor or whoever, the skin specialist, and they just say. It's sun damage.
But this is something that surprised me coming here from England in 1978, and I found even women in their 20s, their skin compared to England, their skin looked very old because it had been so much weathered from being outside. And then 2 years later, when I was going back to England, and I'd see women in their 50s, and they looked as if they had really childish skin because it hadn't been. Well, I got used to the New Zealand thing, and it just their skin hadn't weathered. They'd been inside and protected so much, or the weather's that much milder that it doesn't have those sorts of effects. So, which is good. I'm not so sure because they're saying now there's so much protection. to avoid melanoma, that people are having problems of vitamin D deficiency. Some doctors say, well, actually, the health effects of that are worse than something like a melanoma. Yeah. Take a bit of risk and get some sun. But also, I think the thing in England, you'd easily get sunburnt because you'd... I remember when I was in the Middle East, and if it was in the middle of summer that people from England had come out, you'd almost have to wear sunglasses when you looked at them because their skin was so white it was dazzling. So if you've gone from no exposure to sun to suddenly exposure to full sun, your skin's going to burn. If it's weathered gradually or permanently getting some exposure, then it's not quite as serious.
I guess there's quite a variety in New Zealand of... natural skin tones anyway.
Yes, yeah. Yeah, so fair haired and sort of light skinned people might be more at risk than... But something else I noticed, though, and it might be people who've been farmers here, but you know, if it's bright sunlight and they're outside a lot, their eyes, they're sort of half squinted. It affects the shape of their eyes. From that, I think they're...
My father was fair-skinned, red-haired as a boy, and every summer he'd go out exposed, white from the winter, and he'd expose himself to basically burn his bark, which is what he called his skin, so that, yep, he could get through the summer with damaged skin, I suppose these days it would be damaged skin. But he died at 64, so there was no time to see whether this horrible annual burning would have perhaps been a big problem later.
Thank you for listening to Manawatu Conversations. This and other recent programs can also be found on the Manawatu People's Radio website, and a range of programs is also available on the Manawatu Heritage website of the Palmerston North City Archive. The address for that is manawatuheritage.pncc.govt.nz.
If you enjoy this NPR podcast, please consider subscribing. Our podcasts are available on all major podcasting platforms: Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and Spotify, as well as the accessmedia.nz app. Support this show and others like it by giving a donation. For more information, go to www.npr.nz/donate.